The date is the 29th of May, 2012, and I'm at 1 Major Street with David DePoe, because he has a very special story about his grandfather in this neighborhood from a long time ago. Okay. So, David, I'm handing it over to you, please.
Okay, so my grandfather's name was Hopko. His family was originally from Hungary, and they migrated to the United States. There's an interesting story behind that, which is that his father was a coach driver in the court in Austria, and he took off with a minor princess and stole one of the emperor's coaches and a couple of his best horses, and they fled across Europe.
What year was that, approximately?
That would have been sometime in the 1860s or 70s. I'm not sure exactly. This is from my grandfather. So they got to New York State, and he wanted to become a farmer. He was apparently from a rural background and knew how to work with horses. So they ended up in upper New York State, and my grandfather was the youngest of four boys. I was born in 1882, and the way it worked is the oldest, you know, was entitled to inherit the farm, and maybe the younger one a part of it or something like that. It was a dairy farm that had Holstein cattle, and so my grandfather, realizing that and having an education sort of in the dairy field, ended up moving to Saskatoon. And he was quite a forward-thinking man, and he actually met my grandmother, whose name was Marie Smith, and she never changed her name.
Oh.
She was Scottish, and her name was Marie Smith, and she was a suffragette and a temperance woman. So he started a dairy called the Saskatoon Pure Milk Dairy, which was the first dairy in Western Canada that, as far as I know, that pasteurized milk. He brought in pasteurization, and he also gave a decent price to the farmers because he knew what their life was like. And became a prominent citizen in Saskatoon. He sponsored bowling leagues and softball leagues and so on and so forth. And just before his oldest daughter, my mother, was born in 1916, and then there were three daughters. And it was very interesting that my grandfather, whatever children he had, I'm going to send my children to university.
They were so forward-thinking, both of your grandparents.
Yeah, and so, you know, my mother was part of, you know, not only the temperance league, but she also, you know, campaigned for the vote for women and so on. So, subsequently, he moved the family to Winnipeg because he was asked to run the largest dairy in Manitoba. And so, but then when it came time for his daughters to go, three sisters, to go to university, they had to go to a place where there was a university. So they moved to Whitby, Ontario, and he...
So when would that have been, approximately?
That would have been in the 30s, during the Depression, the early 30s.
Thank you. Yeah.
And so they moved to Whitby, Ontario, and lived in a big house. And, you know, when I was a child, I was taken out to Whitby to visit all these aunts and uncles and relatives and so on and so forth. He got into... he couldn't start a new dairy in the Depression. That was not in the cards. So he started to work for a dairy company that distributed refrigeration equipment. And my mother went to Whitby Normal School, which was sort of preparation for being a teacher. But when it came time for her to go to university, they moved to North Toronto, 53 Briar Hill Avenue, which was a large house which had a third floor apartment, which they rented out in order to make ends meet. And this still was the Depression. And so my mother started at the University of Toronto, and they gave her a packed lunch and a nickel to take the streetcar down Yonge Street.
So she went to university, but it was then on a shoestring.
She went to Victoria College, where she became friends with people like Northrop Frye and so on. So, and one thread that ran through my family was music. And my mother took, studied, she got the Royal Conservatory, qualifications in piano at the highest level, and a certificate. And she studied English at university, English literature, language and literature, as they called it. And she was involved in, putting on Gilbert and Sullivan and all kinds of things at Victoria College. There's some interesting photographs of those things. And all of her stuff actually has been donated to the archives. At all the programs that she kept, she kept everything, my mother. And so, subsequently, the younger daughter Betty also went to Victoria College, and so did the youngest daughter Gwen. My grandparents put them, even though they didn't have a lot of money. And that third floor, and my mother graduated and found a teaching job in Brockville, Ontario, teaching English and music at Brockville High School. And so, on the train to Brockville from Toronto, and found a place to stay. Met my father there at an officer's, inviting all the local single women to a dance. So when they got married, she had to stop teaching. Only spinsters were allowed to teach back then, spinsters. So my grandfather, having moved to Toronto, needed to start a business. And he, right after the war in the late 40s, I think 47 or so, he'd been selling this refrigeration equipment, but he decided to start his own business. So he found a building, the address being 107A Robert Street, in the laneway between Robert and Major Street. And he called his company Milk Case Repairs. And of course, the dairy, which was first Silverwood's and then Borden's, I think, on the Spadina Circle, I think, he repaired their milk cases for them. And I remember going down there, when I was a child. He also, at the same time, he continued to sell that refrigeration equipment. I think he was really busy, but he was a wonderful and warm human being, and he used to take me in his big old car around Southern Ontario to sell this equipment to dairies in Southern Ontario in the summertime when I was on my summer holidays. And, he'd proudly put me up on a stool in the dairy, and I could get a milkshake or an ice cream cone or whatever I wanted. So he was a wonderful, warm man, and one of the best things most outstanding things I can remember about him were his hands. He had huge, strong hands and really thick fingers because he had to milk cows by hand when he was growing up on his dairy farm, right? And he had the strongest hands I could ever see.
Made you feel very safe.
Oh, for
you,
sure.
You were aware.
He'd sit you on his lap. And
What was his name, please?
Archie Mihalko.
How do you spell Mihalko?
M-I-H-A-L-K-O.
Okay, Archie.
Archie, yeah. And so he started this business there and kept up the other, and he finally dropped selling the company he worked for, kind of didn't keep up with the leading edge of refrigeration equipment, and so he just dropped that and kept his company. I've looked it up in the archives, and first it didn't have a name listed, and then it was called Milk Case Repairs, and obviously it was for the nearby dairy, so on.
So what is it that exactly, what is,
well, okay,
what was
milk
his business?
Cases, yes. Milk cases back then had metal frames with wooden slats in the sides, and so what happens is they throw them and crash them around, and they get broken, and his company repaired them. not only for that dairy, but I think a number of other dairies that were in sort of downtown Toronto in that era. Well, you know, the milk bottles that you got in your milk box where you, in the winter, where they it froze and the cream, you know, came rose at the top and all of that stuff. So anyway, that was his business for quite a few years.
So he, but that started in 1947.
Yes.
So when you say quite a few years, do you have any idea when we're talking about 10 years, 12?
It was there for about 7 years, and then he moved it up. And we're vague about this. It looked, some of us think it was up along Caledonia Road, and I think it was at actually the end of Rogers Road, where it meets Weston Road. So anyway, but
it was that end.
We
of
don't
the
know.
City.
I haven't looked it up yet to that point in time, and I don't know why he left that building here. Maybe he'd outgrown it. It's not a very big place. And, you know, now people live in it, right? That's behind 107 Robert Street.
Do you think you have any pictures at all of a milk case repairs company?
I don't. Unless, well, here's where I would have to look. My mother kept scrapbooks, and my sister has in her basement. And I would have to look in my mother's picture albums because she's kept everything. And so I would have to go into my sister's basement and get those picture albums and look for them. And we have photographs of him and my grandmother, who died unfortunately in 1952, when I was 8. I have really good memories of her, but you know, she had a heart attack one day in her kitchen while she was making one of her many pies. And anyway, so and my grandfather, I think, developed some form of dementia, Alzheimer's or something like that, right around sometime in the mid-50s. Because I can remember him coming out and visiting the farm, and he would sleep with my brother Eric, who was next oldest boy in the family. To me. And my father can remember him waking up in the morning and saying he had to go and milk the cows. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember that finally they had to put him into some home. You know, as I recall, it was an awful place. And you know, I went to see him before he died, and he was just lying in a bed and breathing heavily and not really recognizing us and stuff.
But not this man that you remembered who used to take you.
No.
He was working with these big, safe hands.
Wonderful, kind, nurturing and supportive man, you know, and that's the way he was. And by about 57, 58, he was really suffering. He died in 59. So, you know, anyway.
Is there anything else that you remember about that address or about the inside of the building?
Yeah, I do. There was a jumbled pile of broken milk crates, and he had a workman in there with, you know, dressed in like bib overalls. And they were ripping them apart with tools, and they had all kinds of slats of wood that they cut. They had, I think, a bandsaw, and they cut this. It was hardwood they used, and they would cut them, and then they had a riveting machine that would rivet these. They'd drill little holes, and they'd rivet the wooden slats back into the, I think, aluminum frames. It could have been steel, probably steel. Frames of these milk case repairs, and they had these workbenches, and they just bammed away at doing this stuff. And he had a couple of, you know, a riveting machine and a couple of saws, and it was a noisy, rackety place. And again, he had a very good relationship with his workers, you know, and because he was just kind and decent to them. So, yeah, and that. And I hadn't actually remembered where it was until my aunt told me that he had his first Toronto factory down near Brunswick Avenue somewhere, and it didn't turn out to be Brunswick. It turned out to be between Robert and Harvard, with an address that was on Robert Street. So he would have been taking them back over to the dairy. So that's sort of my grandfather.
And that's a long time ago in this neighborhood.
It is.
Is there anybody else who might have some memories, more memories about this business?
Well, I'm the oldest, so I mean, I have the most memories because probably, you know, I was the first grandson, so in some ways I was privileged to spend the most time with him. So, you know, I was in their big old house over on Briar Hill quite a bit, you know, I have some tiny little photographs of birthday parties and things like that. They used to have these tiny little black and white photographs.
Black and white, shiny black and white. Well, if you could possibly get any pictures from the inside or the outside, because it would be interesting for me to take pictures of 107A outside now.
Yes.
And then if you could get even one picture.
And I will also look in the archives because, you know, who was the photographer in this neighborhood? I forget. There was a famous photographer who took pictures of Toronto who lived in this neighborhood, and I can't remember his name now. But I will look in three different places and see what I can find.
Well, the History Committee of Harvard Village Residents Association would really appreciate that because... Yeah. We're having fun doing this project, but we're serious about it,
absolutely.
A lot of people are enjoying it.
Yeah.
And of course, you dropped this piece of paper in my lap at Harvard at our AGM.
Yeah.
And I called you back because I thought this is a little gem that we have.
Yeah. It's just, you know, this man who was really progressive in his day. You know, I mean, I don't know how he got there. I think it probably had something a lot to do with my grandmother. Kind of waking him up to the fact that women had rights. But on the other hand, my aunt told me, my aunt's kind of into some dementia now, but, you know, I asked her a lot of questions. She said it was more him than her, as she remembers it, driving the idea that these young women, these daughters, would go to university. And whatever he had to do to get them there, he would. So they all
graduated. So she was a suffragette, and your mother was... It sounds as if that was a whole family of smart, progressive people. That's the impression.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. And, you know, the legacy continues. You know, I've been... You know, a union negotiator and a activist forever. You know, thanks to my father giving me knowledge about what was going on in the world, I got to go and see Martin Luther King speak in Washington, and I came back. I had to tell my mother I was going to my friend's cottage, and took a bus ride from Ottawa to my father was the sort of anchor on CBC broadcasts sort of the most respected television reporter. He was kind of like the Walter Cronkite of Canada or something.
In what years would...
Well, he got his job in Ottawa in 1960. Mm-hmm. We moved to Ottawa then. And, you know, him and houses, he bought a house that the basement flooded every spring because there was a stream running underneath it.
You said he wasn't great with houses and cars.
A house in a subdivision down along Riverside Drive, sort of, I don't know, south of Mooney's Bay in Ottawa. I don't know if you know Ottawa, but...
I don't.
Oh, we had to put, like... 2x4s on the basement floor so we keep our feet dry when we got out of bed and walked upstairs in the spring, and you know, the sump pump wouldn't burn out. Anyway, never mind. And he bought, like, I mean, when we were living on the farm, here's someone with six kids. He bought a Morris Minor convertible. And he'd come home and he'd leave the top down and it'd rain. And so we'd go out for a Sunday drive, all crammed into this tiny little car with my mother with a baby in his lap, and you know, me with the youngest other one on my lap, and our feet would be in water. So I went out one day with a brace and bit to the four front and back sort of wells in the floor, and took a brace and bit and drilled holes in them so that the water would drain out of them and we wouldn't get our feet soaking wet riding in that car. And the next car he bought was a taxi. There was holes drilled in the dash where they took the meter out of it, and they gave it a quick paint job, and the paint started to flake off right away of this car, and it was blue, sort of light blue, and it looked like a shiny new car, except it had probably 100,000 miles on it or something.
Now, most of the people that I'm interviewing have been here for 40 years or more, but you've been here now for 30 years, I think.
No, just 22 since 1989.
Okay.
Yeah.
Could you, just briefly, because you haven't been here for 40. In the 22 years that you've been here, are there any outstanding changes that you feel have occurred in our neighborhood?
Well, obviously the tearing down of Doctors Hospital and the building of Kensington Gardens is the biggest. I mean, I was heavily involved in negotiations around the Residents Association about making that place appropriate to the neighborhood in terms of height and design and all that kind of stuff. I mean, people are kind of happy that 10-story ugly tower got torn down.
But that tower was the hospital.
Yeah, Doctors Hospital. Mm-hmm. It was here when we moved here. Mm-hmm. Right? And then, what was it, mid-90s when they amalgamated it with Western and decided to, I guess that was the Harris health plan, so-called, and which all always meant cutting some more. And being a teacher, I know that very well. And so I was kind of the tough negotiator with Brian McFarlane on behalf of the Red Association. I mean, I was there with Gus and a bunch of other people and so on.
You wanted to make sure it wasn't going to be another tall structure.
Yeah,
we
also kind of hoped it would get turned into housing appropriate to the neighborhood, but they had a legal concept called as of right. And they had the right, because it had been a medical facility, to build something similar. Mm-hmm. And when they decided to, we could have probably won at the municipal board, but I'd done a lot of research, and we had a nice legal brief from Carl Jaffrey. But we didn't have any money. It would have cost us $10,000, and we didn't have $10,000. So I happened to sing in a choir, a community choir that rehearses at Cecil Street, called the Common Thread Community Chorus. And in the same section, bass section, was the chief architect who was designing the building. So I had many conversations with him, and we became friends, and he listened. So they lowered that building and put a lot of the offices and services into the basement, and sort of dug, windows, so the basement had light.
So much more to the satisfaction of the neighborhood.
Yeah, like the, reference, sort of gable references in the same color of red brick that most of the houses were made of, and the roof line the same height, which was important to have it be the scale of the neighborhood, and sort of those faux sidewalks that go in there, at least architectural references to residential. And so that was an intense period of time, because Brian McFarlane was not very well regarded by the people in this neighborhood. He really wasn't. People really didn't like him. He was not a nice man. So that was my immersion in the Sussex Ulster.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Harvard
but
Village.
You worked hard for that at that time. You were intensely
hours
involved.
Hours and hours. I still have a couple of notebooks of all the meetings we went to up on the top of 340 College in the boardroom and stuff. And heavily disputed ideas were passed back and forth across the table and stuff. It was intense from time to time.
Oh, thank you. Thank you on behalf of all of us.
Yeah, well, I was used to that because in my life as a teacher, after 2 years of teaching, I got laid off and I had to go and teach out in the Peel region. And I became the chief negotiator on behalf of the Peel teachers. So I was used to hours and hours of tough negotiating. So I didn't have any trouble staying tough and reasonable and looking at someone in the eye across the table and saying, you know, really, what you're thinking about isn't acceptable to us as residents, and we have to really think about the fact that you're building this thing in a residential neighborhood, and it has to be appropriate, you know, etc. You know,
That fighting kept our neighborhood what we like it to be, without high rises and structures that really stick in our craw.
Yeah.
Any other? So that's really a wonderful response. Yeah. Any other comments about changes in this neighborhood?
A lot of people have bought in, and the sort of Portuguese-ish character is leaving to a certain extent. You know, people who are Portuguese families are not as prominent here as they were before. There's still some. Mm-hmm. But the women are aging, as you can see, but they're still there. Just up the street here by the laneway, Albert and so on, who lives there, and I guess it's his mother, and so on. What else? I think the rooming houses have remained as rooming houses. Now, this house used to be a student rooming house when we bought it, and so we've transformed it since we bought it. I mean, this used to be a bedroom.
Where we're sitting now.
And if you look very carefully at that wall behind you, you can see that there was a wall there that got taken out. It's been, filled in and covered, but I did that, and repaired the ceiling and, all that. So this was a bedroom. This tiny little space here was a bedroom. And then there's a washroom there that has a shower in it. It was shared by everyone who lives on this floor. And the basement was a contained apartment. It still has a stovetop and cupboards down there. I mean, it's laundry for us now, but there was a kitchen down there, and it's carpeted, And so it was divided into three rooms on this floor, and an upstairs one-bedroom apartment and a basement apartment. When we bought it in 1989.
And you reconstructed it into a one-family dwelling, is that what you did?
Yeah, and that, the reconstruction only started last summer. We had where the staircase is there, there was a wall and a door with a lock on it.
So you lived in it that way for many years?
We lived in
for 20 years.
In the basement, yeah. So it's what we had to do. When you come out of a divorce, you're poor.
Yeah.
Especially the woman ends up poor, but we both ended up poor. So, and this house, I mean, it was really, I met Sue just after she sold another house and bought this one. And so it turned out that between the offer and the closing date, the market crashed and the house lost $30,000, boom. And
how much?
30.
Oh.
And so, just in terms of that, we had to.
So you rented
it. And also rented out. Well, and also she didn't have enough money, so she had a second mortgage too at a high interest rate. And after about 5 years, I called her and said, "You know what? You've made all your money back on the interest already. And so, here's what I'm going to do." We're gonna buy you out, or else we're gonna quit claim on the mortgage, and you can sue us. Like I said, I was a negotiator, and so because you've made more than the value of the mortgage back, in interest, and so I think you just need to let it go now. You
know? And he did.
He did. Yeah, he did. He agreed.
So now the whole house is yours.
Yeah, so now finally. We signed it off. So
you waited a long time for that.
We had a, yeah, and we had a, so then we just had the other mortgage to pay off, and, you know, a year and a half ago it disappeared, a year and a half ago in September, and so we now,
that must
turn it into
feel.
A nice space.
Well, and as you pointed out to me, you have a little oasis behind here.
Yeah.
You've made it
yeah,
very
yeah,
pretty.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, is there anything else that you might want to talk about our neighborhood?
You know what? I love this neighborhood. I think we have one of the most active and progressive neighborhood associations in the city. You know, I love that we've done this tree project.
Mm-hmm.
I love that we're doing this history project. I think it's, you know, I think, you know, the bulk purchase of furnaces and solar panels and all that green project that included the trees really conceptually, and I think thanks to Tim Grant.
Yes.
And I think we've, you know, I mean, I dare say we probably have one of the most, or if not the most active neighborhood association in the city, and it's filled with a whole lot of people with a whole lot of interest who want to take care of the place, you know, and make it better. And I think we have, you know, I mean, I feel really a part of it, you know, and I mean, we've had to do a lot of negotiations with Julie Purdy. Pearly, who owns the Three Times Cafe to keep the noise down. And I mean,
has that worked?
That wall is their back door.
Oh, you're right. It's Three Times.
Yeah, that's right.
So when they have musicians playing, that's right here.
At 11 o'clock, they have to close the back door, and she'll have to turn the air conditioning on. But she bought the house at Three Major Street.
You were talking to me about the back, closing the back door and turning on the air conditioning.
Yeah.
Of Three Times.
Yeah. And. Yeah. Because we got to know Judy and we were friendly with her, and quite often that's our default place to go if we, you know, we're too busy to cook. They have good food.
Right? They do.
And so we just developed a relationship with her, you know, and I mean, Judy is a progressive-minded person herself, you know, and she doesn't want to make trouble for her neighbors. And she's even, for example, got printed up a whole bunch of these big buttons that say "Stop Ford."
So she's political too.
Yeah, she's political too, yeah. And she's from the Pearly family that, you know, that made the Pearly maps. And
yes.
Her brother, what's his name, Gary, was a real political sort of Canadian nationalist. Radical in the 70s, he sort of a socialist nationalist, and he had an organization called the Canadian Liberation Front or something like that, you know. And so, I don't know, you know, there's a lot of history of Jewish communists in this city.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that's where the tradition her family came out of, you know. I mean, the people who organized the garment workers' unions on Spadina were mostly members of the Canadian Communist Party, and good on them, because they managed to, even though, you know, starting in the 40s and 50s, there was all the red baiting and McCarthyism. I mean, thanks to them, really, we have, you know, workers' rights in this country to a great extent.
Well, and of course, it's something that you and Sue, your wife, share with Judy, mm-hmm. the union and making.
Yeah, kind of, you know, and the place is a home to folk music, and that has a tradition, too, of sort of social progressiveness of some kind, you know. So I don't know. I mean, and you know, I do a little bit of singing myself. You know,
you said you're in a choir still.
Yeah, I was in the choir. Not now. I've taken a leave from it to sort of do more politics. I'd like to get involved with, you know, the Stop the Cuts thing against Ford and the Custis City programming and all these, you know, recreation programming and stuff, closing them, arenas and community centers and all this stuff that he was trying to do, and the war on the bicycles and all these awful things that he stands for. So I've actually devoted a lot of time to that in the last couple of years. You know,
well, there's a lot of good work that we can do as volunteers in our city and in our community. Mm-hmm. You mm-hmm. know that you've done it, and I'm doing it.
Yeah. And I mean, I just think to make this city work, there needs to be cultural groups, political groups, environmental groups, neighborhood building groups. You know, I mean, you know, to have a city building vision, I mean, there need to be transit advocacy groups. There need to be all kinds of people who advocate for making this city a more livable place to live. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite happy to take my place in that panoply of, you know, people. I mean, back in 89, I was one of the founding members of the task force to bring back the Dawn. And I founded something called the Teachers Environmental Network at the Toronto Board and the Toronto District School.
So that's all part of a large part. That's your community work. So
yeah.
You've been active in it, and you talked about what you did with Doctors Hospital.
Yeah. So it's you know, it just, I mean, whatever falls to hand for me, you know, I'm way back in the 70s. I dropped out of university to join the 60s.
Uh-huh.
And I went back in 69 and got involved in student politics. And also, because of my, you know, sort of history, having seen Martin Luther King, and when I was in U of T, first time around, I was part of Toronto Friends of SNCC, which was, it's the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. This university students organized registering black voters in the American Senate.
I remember that.
Yeah. I went down there with my friend Paul Saltzman, who was the son of the iconic weatherman with the chocolate.
Oh, I remember him.
His name, Percy Saltzman.
I remember Percy Saltzman.
Yeah, anyway, he's Percy's son. So we both had something in common. We had famous people as fathers, you know. Anyway, he went down to Mississippi, and he got thrown in jail, and I escaped getting killed. I was driving down a rural road with a black student from Boston University, and we had these voter registration things, and all of a sudden this pickup truck pulled up beside us, and I looked over, and there was a shotgun poking out of the window. I jammed on my brakes. The shotgun went off, and they missed us because they had kept going, right? I turned the truck right around the back way and floored it, and we drove straight back to Atlanta, which was the SNCC headquarters. We were scared. Right. And we said, we're sorry, first of all. I think a black man and a white man in a truck is probably not a good idea. Second, we're completely scared out of our minds, you know. And I mean, I'm 20 years old and I'm like flipping out. So, anyway, but we had this support organization here, and we filled Convocation Hall with fundraising concerts and things like that, you know.
So you've been an activist for many years.
Yeah, and so it was, you know, so I, you know, and I got asked by the ANC rep in Toronto to. I went to him and said, you know, mid-80s, what can we do about apartheid? And
you know what? I'm going to have to.
Yeah.
I'm going to turn this off, and we'll continue to talk about
sure.
that. Okay.
Yeah,
but I just want to ask, let's just ask one more question, and that is, what made you move to this neighborhood? And then we'll talk about the other.
Really, you know what? Sue had bought a house that she could afford. That's really, really, on a very pragmatic level. She could live in part of it and rent out the rest.
Uh-huh.
Single mom with a child and just needed to do that.
So you moved here because she had this place,
yeah.
But you've never looked back,
mm-hmm.
clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We love living here.
Yeah.
It's a great place to live.
Well, I'm going to turn this off, and we can continue to talk about that, because
sure.
I lived in the States during some of those years.
Did you?
I experienced them.
Sure.
But I want to say thank you very much for all this interesting, valuable information.
It's fun. You know, I just, this is just what I've been doing for a long time. You know, for me, I just have this sense of you need to make a contribution to wherever you are, from whoever you are. You know?
And you do. Well, and of course, as I said before, we were at the AGM, and you heard Richard speak, and before I knew it, I had this piece of paper in my hand,
yeah,
because
sure.
You had something to add. Yeah. So thank you
yeah.
very, very
yeah,
much.
It's fun.